This is The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. I'm going to start this program about water education with moving water. White water, swift water, water in rivers. We all have to be taught how to read water, just like we have to be taught how to read a book or how to swim. Even baby geese have to be taught how to swim upstream. I watched a crew of goslings last week prodded into an eddy by their mom. It was like they didn't believe her, that they wouldn't be swept downstream. She would push them in and they'd cruise up a few yards and get out, and she'd keep doing that until they were out of sight. Some people get really, really good at reading water. My friend Jeff is an expert whitewater kayaker. He's paddled all over the world, and he knows so much about what to do in a river that he teaches other people what to do in a river, which is not an easy thing to do. I was recently trying to tandem kayak with a friend and trying to teach her how to read water at the same time. I found myself saying, "You just feel it. You just feel it." You know, like when my dad was teaching me to drive a stick shift. Not useful at all. So I called Jeff. And I asked him how he does it. Are you there?
I am. I'm Jeff Hasbone, and I'm a swiftwater instructor for the Swiftwater Safety Institute out of Jackson, Wyoming.
Do you remember what it felt like the first time you got into moving water?
Yeah. The very first time I got into moving water, I got in on the side of the river where the water was not moving very much, and I paddled out into the current, and I flipped over and had to pull the skirt on my kayak and swim immediately.
And what did it feel like swimming in that water?
It was very cold. This was in upstate New York, so there was a foot of snow on the ground when I was doing this. That cold was definitely the first thing, and just afraid because I had to get my kayak to shore, I had to get myself to shore, I was moving downshore and bouncing along pretty shallow rocks.
So I'm assuming that you've learned how to deal with situations like that, and you know how to teach other people how to deal with situations like that. So what exactly is the purpose of Swiftwater Rescue, and who are you teaching it to?
So the purpose of Swiftwater Rescue is to give people the set of tools and experiences that they need to be able to help people who are stuck in a swiftwater scenario that they don't want to be in. The sort of most obvious students in the class are search and rescue people or firefighters as well. So firefighters are the ones often called upon in these rescue situations. Those are the professionals that we teach. We also teach Army and Navy and parajumpers, other folks who are sort of professional rescuers. And then I teach every day private kayakers and rafters. I teach raft guides and kayak instructors, and I will also teach people who work on water as a part of their profession, but the water component isn't the main part of their job. So I've taught a class to weed management people in Wyoming.
Weed management, as in like invasive species on the banks?
That's right. Invasive species that they needed to remove. Once you learn how, the easiest way down a river corridor, if the river is big enough, is on the river. And it's just an easy way to carry a lot of gear with you. And if you're taking sprays for noxious weeds and invasive species, then it's a pretty easy way to move that stuff.
So what do people actually learn? Like, what are the skills that you need to either rescue people or rescue yourself from moving water?
Swiftwater rescue is interesting because it's a mixed bag of things. You learn components of vertical rescue, so like what the search and rescue teams in Yosemite would do to extricate climbers from a vertical scenario. You sort of learn that kind of stuff. That's sort of the most technical end of things. That would be like a vertical extraction off of a bridge, down to how to throw a bag full of rope to someone that's in the river. It's probably the simplest skill and maybe the most important. And then another important sort of simple thing is getting people in the water and swimming in the current and understanding how to move around in the river system without the aid of a boat, and just understanding how those currents are moving them, what they're going to do with them, and what they can do.
Is there like a rule number one or like the most important takeaway from a swiftwater rescue class?
Rule number one is that you are the most important person as far as safety goes. And so never to do anything that puts yourself or the rest of your rescue crew in danger. Things change rather quickly in swiftwater rescues, and so you have to just really be careful that you're never putting yourself in danger. And the worst thing is for a rescue to become an additional victim.
Why do you like teaching swiftwater rescue?
Oh, I love teaching swiftwater rescue. Part of it is just being able to teach people about this place I love. I love rivers. I love moving water. And to be able to bring people out there and just show them how it works, show them the inner workings of the river and how you can move around on the river and what you need to do to do that, all encapsulated in a 3-day course, is just a really fun thing to do. One of the most interesting things that I've been told by a lot of my students is I didn't know how much I didn't know. And I think that's a really valuable thing to take away from this, is that from a conversation about a swiftwater rescue class, is that while we teach firefighters and we teach search and rescue people, we also teach people who have only been boating for a year or so. And everyone has something to learn, and I think a lot of people, the more time you spend on the water, the more likely something is going to happen to someone in your group, whether that's you or the person next to you. And even though you're not a rescue professional, swiftwater rescue training can be very invaluable, and to you more so than a lot of folks who are rescuers by trade.
My boyfriend in high school was a kayaker, and the first time I got into a river, I came from California and I swam in the ocean and I, was an expert swimmer in swimming pools, but I just had no idea what moving water would feel like. I was like 17 years old and I was like, oh, I'm a great swimmer. And I jumped in the water and by the time, I popped up out of my dive, I was 500 yards down the river. And it's an interesting sort of baptism to sort of learn how powerful a river is.
There's a reason we get so much energy in this country from moving water. I can't believe how often I'm surprised by jumping in the river and feeling how much power it has over me.
Jeff Hasboon, he's an instructor with the Swift Water Safety Institute and a fellow Pisces. We're going to get out of the water here for our next story and talk about water conservation. Different states have different approaches to teaching, incentivizing, coaching, or even forcing residents to change their habits. What works? TV commercials? Outrageously expensive water bills? The source's Ross Chambliss has this story about Utah's efforts to slow the flow.
If you watch television and you live in Utah, you've probably seen these advertisements.
This is two nights in a row.
I need you.
You think you need me?
I have brown spots.
So you're turning me on again?
It doesn't work?
No. It only makes your lawn's roots shallow.
Oh, water. I've been such a fool.
Don't cry. It's wasteful.
Or maybe you've seen this one.
Sometimes it seems like we have plenty of water. But in reality, Utah is the second driest state in America. Drier than New Mexico. Drier than Arizona.
Or perhaps this one.
Each year, Utah is blessed with water. But each year, our population continues to grow. We all need to conserve to make sure there's enough to go around.
You get the idea. These ads target those homeowners who fancy the opulent green lawns. About 15 years ago, the Utah Division of Water Resources, along with an assembly of the state's largest water conservancy districts, launched their Slow the Flow ad campaign. Its messages, you could say, have been evolving.
We're sort of learning along the way.
This is Eric Klotz.
I'm with the Utah Division of Water Resources, and I'm the Water Conservation and Education Section Manager.
Back in 2001, Utah was experiencing a major drought, and then Governor Mike Leavitt called together the state's top water gurus, wanting to know what they were doing to encourage water conservation. Klotz says they pulled together their numbers on how municipal water gets used.
And one of the major things that we had discovered, with that data is that 3/4 of our water use, our municipal water use, goes to the residential category, to our homes, and 2/3 of that water is used outside.
Klotz says they then hired some media consultants, R&R Partners based in Las Vegas, who helped them to target the campaign.
And it was basically single family homes, residential, outdoor.
These neighbors both have beautiful yards. Yet one waters half as much as the other.
At this time, the division also set a goal for statewide water conservation. And in retrospect, they set the bar pretty low. Cut 25% of statewide per capita use by the year 2060. In just 10 years, they reached 18%.
Now, to say that slow the flow is responsible for that, probably not.
Probably not, because trends like xeriscaping and more efficient irrigation practices saw a big push during the 2000s. A few years ago, Governor Herbert pulled the goal up to 2025. Also, around this time, Klotz says the state identified a new sub-target group for their media campaign.
And that was males age 18 to 44 years old who, according to the surveys and the focus groups, were not getting the message on water conservation. And I'll go so far as to say could care less about it. And yet we found they are, for the most part, in charge at their homes with the controllers, the sprinkler controllers. So they're doing the watering, and they don't care about conservation.
So since then, Klotz says many of the Slow the Flow ads go after the men of the household. Interestingly, before long, Slow the Flow found a new partner.
Hi, I'm Craig Martin, general manager of Rio Tinto Stadium. And this is Dan Farns, our lawn guru, also known as the Grass Whisperer. To make your lawn feel as beautiful and special as a pitch here at Rio Tinto, first, don't overwater.
If you see so when Real came to us, it was like almost like a no-brainer that their demographics is like almost perfect for us. And not only their demographics, but their season. Because we're talking, remember I mentioned that we're kind of emphasizing outdoor watering. Mm-hmm. Their season runs right during the irrigation
season. Through the
season.
Summer, through the hot times, the hot months.
So with a new target on educating the guys, the division last year found that residents watered less often compared to 2010 numbers. Per capita, people also ran their tap or shower for less time, and more people reported watering their yards only at certain times, like avoiding the middle of the day.
Also, 65% turned off. This was key. 65% indicated in 2014 survey that they turned off the water after it rained versus 10% in 2010. And in a year like this year, where these spring rains have been wonderful, that's a positive sign, and we hope more and more people do that.
Still, one might take the Division of Water Resources numbers with a grain of salt. A legislative audit released in May this year found that the agency was relying on flawed data. The report challenged their forecast that Utah will be running out of water in coming decades. The agency has been saying that Utahns, even with conservation measures, will need to pay $33 billion in coming years for upgrades to infrastructure, maintenance, and new water projects for a growing population. Meanwhile, Utahns still rank among the highest per capita water users in the West.
Getting good water conservation results can't solely be done in an advertising campaign.
Zach Frankel with Utah Rivers Council is a longtime critic of the state's conservation efforts.
And so for nearly 15 years, that's all the state of Utah has been doing to conserve water, while it simultaneously has great reservations about saving water.
If you've heard Frankel talk before, he likes to remind Utah residents how exactly we pay for water. We pay not only through our city water bills, but also through property taxes, which he says amounts to a hidden subsidy for water providers. It also means that the people who hose down their driveways or who let their sprinklers run in the middle of a downpour, they don't feel a financial pinch.
You know, in Las Vegas, there are water cops that cruise around and give citations by following the water in the gutter upstream until they find out who is watering concrete. Mm. They will fine you for that. Here in Utah, it just warrants a shrug because it happens on street after street after street. And all that we get out of the state is lip service.
Frankel advocates for more steeply tiered water rate structures. The idea is that people learn the value of water by how much they're charged for it. And different Utah cities sell water to customers using very different rate structures. If you live in Park City, for example, your water bill tells you, hey, this water is limited. be very careful how you use it. But if you live in, say, Orem City, your water bill says, you know, don't worry about it. Wasting water, not such a big deal.
What we need are smarter tiers with our water rates. We don't need to be draconian in our water rates to educate people to use less. What we're really trying to do is discourage very high-end water waste. So we're not trying to go after every single homeowner and gouge them. What we're trying to do is to get people to not use 30,000, 40,000, 50,000 gallons. We're not trying to discourage people from using 5, 10, or 15,000 gallons of water. We're trying to say, stop watering your sidewalk and your driveway. Use a broom, not a hose.
There are active conversations specifically about that.
This is Joshua Palmer.
I'm with the Utah Division of Water Resources, and I'm the Public Information Officer.
Palmer says the agency does encourage pricing structures to promote conservation.
Sometimes it's not as simple as just going from, okay, well, we do it this way, and now we're going to do it this other way. And so we want to be methodical, and we want to make sure that we're doing the right thing. We don't think anything is off of the table when it comes to talking about helping Utahns make the right decisions when it comes to conserving. We just all have to do better.
In truth, raising a fee or a tax is generally never popular, especially in conservative places like Utah. Politics tends to get in the way. Still, the state is trying to do more than just some funny ads about saving water. Josh Palmer says they've been pushing a weekly lawn watering guide through social media.
We estimate that if people would just follow the lawn watering guide between April and October every year, that we would save 24 billion gallons of water. That's pretty significant. So, we're trying to give people tools that can really make those decisions for them. And can make sure that their landscapes are healthy, but they're also water-wise. And so a lot of it is just helping people understand how much of an impact those simple decisions make.
Be that as it may, people sometimes need more than just information to change behavior.
Direct contact with the public is very important.
Joanna Enderwada researches water management and conservation at Utah State University. She says they find people tend to overwater because maintaining an irrigation system can be complicated and cumbersome.
So one element of the flow that's a very actionable element is the water check program that's conducted through USU Extension. And that is a program where people can sign up for a free water check, and water checkers go to their property and check their irrigation systems and their landscape characteristics and give them a very specific set of recommendations on how they can conserve water in their particular yard.
So-called social norming strategies can also help. That's where cities show homeowners and businesses in their water bills how their water use compares with their neighbors. Studies show people often want to behave how their neighbors behave. And if you show people that their neighbors are doing better, maybe conserving water better, a homeowner may likely change to be less wasteful. Enderwada says conservation campaigns should come with a variety of approaches.
Because different ones work for different people, and I think that is the reason, from a scientific point of view, it has been hard to disentangle which one is most effective.
As I said in the beginning, the state's conservation campaign is evolving. During our interview, Josh Palmer, who works with Eric Klotz on the Slow the Flow campaign, tried to explain.
We're also interested in community-based pushes. So, for example, Eric was driving into work a few months ago, and he pulled me in, and he said, you know, Josh, we've got to do something about some businesses who are just ignoring that it recently rained and that are watering anyway. You know, you could tell in his eyes, he's a pretty calm person, but there's a little bit of fire in him that day. And so what we did is we said, okay, how do we change behavior? How do we really make a difference? And so we created a really simple campaign called Waterwise Businesses Get My Business. and we put it out on social media, and it was and we boosted it. We tried to get it out there as much as we could. So we advertised it on social media, got a lot of likes, a lot of shares, and so it starts putting that pressure. But we wanted it to be that positive pressure, right? Of people saying, I'm going to support the businesses who make good decisions when it comes to water.
Palmer says they also reached out to chambers of commerce and asked them to give conservation tips to local businesses. They tried framing the issue around economic self-interest, that conserving water is good for the financial bottom line, and that customers prefer businesses that pay attention to smart water use. Whether any of these approaches are truly going to be effective, well, it's too early to tell.
But when we see people engaging in these things, when we see people sharing it with their friends, then we know that it's starting a conversation. And I think that's where conservation starts. It starts with a conversation.
For The Source, I'm Ross Chambliss.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source. And iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
I'm Tom Williams. As you've heard, the U.S. Supreme Court upheld a key provision of the Affordable Care Act. This means almost certainly that the Affordable Care Act will continue at least to the end of President Obama's presidency. And we're going to look at what this means for Utah in a special edition of Access Utah, 10 o'clock this morning, following The Source. Look at potential Medicaid expansion and other topics, and hope to hear from you. Access Utah Special Edition, 10 o'clock this morning, following The Source.
You're listening to The Source. I'm Jennifer Pemberton. Slow the Flow educates the public about better water usage. This next story is about educating the public by using water, and a lot of it. 550,000 gallons to be exact. That's how much water is contained at the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium in Draper. We sent Source producer Ryan Cunningham to the aquarium to find out how and why Living Planet has brought sharks to the second driest state in the nation.
I'm here at the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium in Draper, Utah. The facility, which just opened in March last year, is packed with young families and literally busloads of school children. As you can probably tell from the background noise, a lot of kids are pretty excited to be here. I'm here today to talk to Susie Broadbent, who's the Director of Marketing and Sales at the Living Planet. She's going to tell me about how the aquarium got started and how things work around here. But first she wants to show me around. The first exhibition she takes me to is the penguin enclosure, where two baby Gentoo penguins have recently hatched. She explains to me the penguins' rather peculiar and frankly adorable mating rituals.
You know, mating season is once a year, and so they put in these stones in there, our husbandry team, and that's part of the courtship process. So you can see this penguin right here. He'll carry that stone over to its mate.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, at the beginning of the courtship, the female will either accept it or not. And then the male will have to go back and get it. But when they accept it, they start building a nest. And so they continue to bring, you can see how many pebbles are around each nest. And then that's kind of like their nest where they'll lay an egg and, you know, take care of their baby.
So the males try to win the females over by presenting the biggest, shiniest rock.
Yeah. Does it sound familiar?
It does sound familiar, doesn't it? Yeah.
Yeah. So.
The Gentoo penguins are one of the most popular attractions at the aquarium, but there are hundreds of other species that reside here. The building is divided into four main sections. Antarctic Adventure, where the penguins hang out. Ocean Explorer, which is home to deep sea creatures like sharks and stingrays. Journey to South America, which is designed to resemble a section of the Amazon rainforest. And Discover Utah, featuring wildlife from all over the state.
So here you can see how we just take you through southern Utah, through each of the major waterways. So these would be fish and an exhibit that you would find at Lake Powell as you continue on.
Mm-hmm.
This would be our Green River and then Flaming Gorge Tank.
The entire room kind of transitions from Red Rock to...
You start going northern Utah now, which ends up with one of the favorites, which is the otters. So let's go check these guys out.
Unfortunately for us, the river otters are hiding in back as aquarium employees prepare their lunch. Susie explains to me why otters aren't allowed to mingle with the aquarium employees.
Interestingly enough, as cute as the otters are, our trainers are never in the exhibit with them. So when they come out to place food, they pull the otters off exhibit so they can put the food out. Then when they're off, they'll release the otters, you know?
Yeah.
Because even though they're cute, they are pretty aggressive.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why when they have to like hose out or clean up in here, you won't see the otters on exhibit, but they'll be right back.
Trained river otters, penguin courtship rituals, it's fascinating stuff. And really, we've only scratched the surface so far. But what's almost just as fascinating is the aquarium's own sort of rags to riches tale. When Susie and I find a quieter place to sit down and chat, the first thing I ask her about is the Living Planet's humble beginnings.
The Draper facility now that you're in is big and beautiful. It's a wonderful aquarium. But you guys started in a van, didn't you?
Yeah. So I think it's a great story of entrepreneurship and what's possible if, you know, a child or somebody has a dream, and although there's not something available, they can make it happen. So our founder, Brent Anderson, as a child, it sparked his interest, this marine biology and scuba diving. And the more he looked, there just was no resources for him to really learn about that. And so when he went to college, he went out to Santa Barbara and got his marine biology degree and decided to bring that information back to Utah and see if there were other interested people like him that shared this interest. And so, yeah, he did start out in a van going to junior highs with invertebrates and things that he could bring for hands-on, and kids would stay after and get to learn about this. And over time, it just has shown that the interest is certainly there and students want to learn about this.
This was back in 1998 when he started the van,
yes.
Right?
Uh-huh.
What kind of animals was he able to bring onto the van?
I think things that were more easily transportable, probably like invertebrates, which are like sea stars and urchins. Although I did hear rumors about like moon jellies and some eels and stuff, so I think he got creative.
Okay, so then I want to say it was 2004 that the aquarium moved from a van to a spot in the Gateway Mall.
Yeah, so there continued to be this interest, so I think Brent decided to, okay, let's experiment and open up a temporary, like, showcase aquarium. It was only 10,000 square feet. The admission was really inexpensive, and just to see if there was an interest, and it was just like one little hall that looped around, and quickly there generated a line around the corner, and it was clear, okay, there's more of a demand. And so shortly after that, we moved from there to Sandy, which was a 46,000 square foot facility, and we were able to open different halls, and it was there that we were able to bring in otters, which was a big deal, and then our penguins, which was another huge deal for us.
Was that an existing building, or was that built for the aquarium?
That was an existing building. People that have been around long enough know that it was like a grocery store.
Really?
Before we went in there. So we went in there and leased the building and built it out the best that we could, and I think it was great. But then when you come here and see this beautiful facility, it's like, wow, this is incredible.
Yeah, so tell me about... You had all these animals in this grocery store, what used to be a grocery store in Sandy, and then you had to move them here to this new facility in Draper. That sounds really hard. How did you do that?
You know, absolutely a thought-out and challenging process, if you can imagine all the dynamics, because not only were we moving animals, but we were bringing new animals in to be able to accommodate this facility, and there's a quarantine process that they have to go through when we get these new animals. Same with the tanks here. They have to cycle, and it takes time for the water to be at the right levels that are unique based on the marine life that is going in that tank. So there were a lot of variables involved. We had an offsite warehouse where we had some of the fish. We had a huge shark tank over there as we brought in sharks. So it took a lot of work.
And the design of the building is actually pretty interesting. The person who designed it was an employee of the aquarium. Can you tell me that story?
Yeah, sure. Brent draws everything out, and he certainly is a visionary like you would want an entrepreneur to be. So he had the site, but was able to collaborate with Ari Robinson, our art manager, who, interestingly enough, he was one of the kids that would stay after school and hang out to, you know, when the aqua van was at his school. So, you know, that he's somebody that definitely loved that marine science aspect. And so, yeah, together it's been amazing what, you know, Brent can think up and then Ari can draw out and then they can come together and have this built out, because I do think it is such a unique and beautiful space.
How big is the facility here in Draper?
So this facility here is 136,000 square feet compared to the 46,000 square feet what we had over in Sandy. And we have about 550,000 gallons of water here, 300,000 of which is the Shark Tank.
Okay, that sounds like a lot of water to manage. Since this is a show about water, I was going to ask you how you do that. How do you keep the tanks clean? How do you make sure that the temperature and the saltiness of the water is just right? How do you do that?
It's a great question, because there is actually a lot of behind-the-scenes work that goes into creating a safe and clean environment for species from all over the world in all these different ecosystems, and temperatures and pH levels and salt water and fresh water. So our husbandry team basically does a check every single day on temperature and just spot checks. At least once a week, they're taking at least 15% of that water, cleaning it, filtering it, scrubbing it, and then they're able to reuse that water. So that was really important to our team on that. The Shark Tank, same thing. We have two stories of filtration systems. So a large amount of that water can be reused.
So do you take in a lot of water, or is it mostly just recycled water that you use?
We do our best to reuse as much water as possible. And I don't know the amount of how much comes in. I just know that they made a lot of custom changes to create a pretty innovative water reclamation or reuse program here.
It has to be pretty energy intensive, too, to keep all that running and maintained. I think I heard you say just before the interview that there's solar panels on the floor.
Yeah, so we obviously are, as an educational facility, one of our messages is conservation. And we want to educate people on minimizing that footprint on our earth as much as anybody. And so we have tried to utilize everything. You'll notice in the aquarium, it's all LED lights. And so those take much less energy than a regular bulb. More expensive, but, you know, in the long run, it's better for the environment. We have solar panels on our roof, like phase one, and we do have an interactive display. So kids can come on a sunny day and see how much energy is being saved based on the sun that the solar panels are receiving. So that's a fun learning experience for them as well.
You know, I tend to forget when I come here, because I'm so overwhelmed by how cool it is to see sharks and penguins and otters and everything else you have here. But it is an educational facility. You are trying to teach kids in particular about ecosystems and habitats. What are some of the ways that you do that?
So, yes, first and foremost, we are an educational facility. Within the aquarium, as our visitors and guests come through, you know, we have signage, we have educators at all the tanks. You'll see, but we've got all these different ecosystems or exhibit halls that have their own immersive experience that we've tried to create the best that we can. So when our guests go in, they kind of get an idea, this is what it would be like in the Amazon, or this is what it would be like in southern Utah. And so we want to educate there, because the whole idea of the living planet is to showcase diverse ecosystems from around the world and show how they're all really dependent on each other, even though they're different, to create the living planet. In addition to the experiences that our guests have coming here, we have a really aggressive and growing education department. Last year, we were able to reach over 100,000 students in the year, which was a huge milestone for us. And that's through our outreach program, which now we've got lots of vans that go out and visit the students, and also through our field trip programs where classes can come on site and do a field trip with our educators or with their teacher throughout the aquarium.
Yeah, I saw a few school buses out there today, actually.
Every day.
You did mention that there's a Utah exhibit.
Yes.
Within the aquarium. I wanted to ask you why that was important to include Utah in the aquarium.
For sure. A couple of reasons. One, this is what you have right here in your backyard. I think a lot of people don't even realize all the life that's out there. And our Utah Hall goes from southern Utah up to northern Utah. And for example, our river otters, a lot of people don't realize are actually native to Utah.
Right.
And you can see them. We have, since we've got our new building, we have seen so many tourists come through that are visiting Salt Lake, and now they're coming to the aquarium. So I love that there's a Utah Hall, because then they can learn a little bit about the state while they're here, in addition to seeing, you know, the other areas of the aquarium.
So this is the big question. Why is it so important to have an aquarium in Utah, which is, it's a landlocked state.
Sure.
It's very dry. It doesn't seem like the most natural place to have an aquarium. So why put an aquarium in
right.
Utah?
I think your question answers the questions, right? I think without an aquarium here, there's a large percentage of kids and adults that never leave the state. So if you think about it, a lot of locals will never have the opportunity to see the ocean, right? So you put this beautiful aquarium in a landlocked state, and what an amazing opportunity to come and see a shark swim over your head if maybe you never have that opportunity to go scuba diving, right? Let alone just see the ocean shore. So I think that's been a lot of the success, because it's a unique experience that people can't get anywhere else close by.
Just from a personal perspective, what brings you to the aquarium? What do you like about it?
Wow, you know, I think most people here, including myself, just love the animals. You know, it's great. Of course, we want to, you know, run and make sure like operations and everything is smooth, but I won't lie, it is a perk of working here that when you would like to go sit in front of the shark tank and just view that awesomeness, or go see the penguins, that is a perk that I can't get anywhere else at a job. So it's pretty fun. Every day when we walk through, we try and ask questions and learn a little bit more. My best compliment on a tour that I was giving is they asked if I was a marine biologist. And I thought, hey, I've learned some stuff then.
Did you play along, or did you?
No, but I was like, thank you. What a compliment. I'm not. And they were like, well, you're very knowledgeable, and thank you for the information. And I just thought, this is pretty cool. I'm learning about ecosystems. I feel like I'm learning something that's valuable for our purpose here on Earth. And, you know, we often talk about here that we want to celebrate all life on Earth. So plants, animals, marine life. And so that's a pretty great message to get behind and have as a career.
Again, that was Susie Broadbent, the Director of Marketing and Sales at the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium. That message that all life is worth celebrating and protecting is what induces that too often elusive sense of wonder the Loveland Living Planet Aquarium strives to foster. I mean, sure, watching fearsome sharks swim right overhead does manage to stir a lot of oohs and ahs, but at the end of the day, after the minivans and school buses have departed and the kids are back at home, I like to believe that those junior Jacques Cousteaus aren't thinking about how scary the sharks are, but instead they're thinking about how special they are, and what a gift it is to share a planet with them. For The Source, I'm Ryan Cunningham.
From the Living Planet Aquarium to an ancient sea, Carrie Bringhurst takes us to the Natural History Museum of Utah when The Source continues.
Support for The Source on Utah Public Radio comes from Utah State University, celebrating the 2015 Year of Water, water expertise at its source, and iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education.
The Natural History Museum of Utah tells a story through its architecture, and its placement right at the Bonneville Shoreline Trail reminds us that this place used to be underwater. The museum is home to displays that show how important water is to shaping the land and the cultural history of the state. Carrie Bringhurst talked to a variety of people working at the museum about their role in telling the story of water in Utah, both inside the walls of the museum and programs that take the learning outdoors.
A brilliant orange copper from a Utah mine wraps the exterior of the Utah Museum of Natural History. The structure is nestled into the foothills of the Wasatch Mountain Range, and everything about the structure's design represents some aspect of the state's ecological and geographical diversity. At first glance, you're drawn to the contours, the up and down angles that match the movement of the natural red rock background. Before entering the museum, you can hike or mountain bike along the Bonneville shoreline or the museum's main street, a reminder of how much the environment here has changed, telling a visual tale of how once upon a time, much of the local terrain here was covered by water.
I think that Utah is so unique because it's looked like so many different habitats within the course of its being.
This is Natalie Toth. She would know. She's an education outreach specialist for the Utah Museum of Natural History.
But if we go back even further in time, I mean, Utah has been covered by vast oceans and, you know, deep marine seas, and it's looked like a beach and a giant wetland and, you know, a giant tributary system with meandering streams. And so, you know, water really is responsible for shaping the landscape that we look outside and see today. I think the museum is so great in that it kind of ebbs and flows naturally as you walk through it, and it's really apparent to see the influence of water, whether that's, you know, influencing where ancient peoples had once settled in our state to, you know, how a fossil is going to form or what type of rocks are going to be formed in our geologic history. So it's truly shaped everything we have in our building.
In her role as an education specialist, Toth is responsible for helping to bridge the gap between the scientific community and the public. She's always looking to the museum's anthropologists, the botanists there, and the vertebrate zoologists to demonstrate how studying the past can help us understand more about the future.
Somebody that actually comes to mind is one of our researchers, Dr. Eric Rickert. He's the curator of vertebrates at the museum. He has this fantastic project where he is revisiting localities that were once visited 100 years ago, and he does a side-by-side comparison from old photographs of what the habitat looked like 100 years ago versus today. And it's truly amazing to see how those impact ecosystems have been impacted by humans and even, you know, by different creatures and different flora and things that have come to inhabit the area over time. And, you know, water is really the catalyst for the reason that those changes have happened.
My name is Eric Rickert, curator of vertebrate zoology at the Natural History Museum of Utah at the University of Utah. A curator in the real sense of the use of that term is a scientist who works in a museum, who deals directly with archival information, including collections and collection records, and does field work himself or herself to add to those collections. With respect to biological collections, natural history museums are the most important repositories of data on the diversity of life in the world. The things that museums have added to it is that we're able to go into our collections and reconstruct what animal and plant communities were like in the past. We're able to look at herbarium sheets or plant specimens from the past, and by looking at the date and where they were collected and looking at the stage of flowering or fruiting that they are in, tell us something about what the seasonality of the plants is. And plants are blooming a lot earlier than they used to in many parts of the country because things are warming up. Spring is coming earlier. And, you know, so that the in some cases, people think that this might be good for agriculture because the growing season might be getting longer. But out here in the West, you know, the spring may be relatively cool with a lot of moisture, but the problem is we're facing these summers that are getting hotter and hotter, and that means seasonal drought.
We've learned a lot about how Rickert studies the habitat history of Utah plants and mammals to help answer ways water can be a lens, a looking glass of sorts, to help explain how changes in the habitat could be a result of changes in patterns of moisture or water patterns, or vice versa. His research is housed and displayed within the museum walls, but Rickart says it is by going out of doors that he learns the most. It is that same concept, learning while outdoors, that led the museum to seek funding for a teacher training program known as TLO, or Taking Learning Outdoors.
Yeah, I think what's so great about, most things that students learn indoors when they're, reading about something in a textbook is that you're able to translate a lot of that into the outdoors, no matter really what the topic is. Students just love being outside.
That was Natalie Toth again. She and her supervisor, Jessica Seppi, oversee the Outdoor Learning Program, or TLO, a way of connecting Utah's K-12 teachers with the natural world through field trips, classroom visits, and innovative educational resources, all of which, they say, are centered on water quality and quantity, as well as biodiversity, geosciences, and sustainability. She says through collaborations with scientists and graduate students, classroom teachers, and informal educators, the program is helping to promote a deeper understanding of science and nature through authentic learning experiences across Utah's watersheds.
This program, Taking Learning Outdoors, really takes advantage of that student and teacher love of being outside in nature and really using the natural environment to convey certain topics. So, you can look at a picture of a soil profile in any textbook that we have in a classroom, but for a student to really be outside and to get their hands dirty and to be able to, touch the soil and the earthworms and the bugs and the grass and everything that's in there, that's the experience that really makes the science stick and really helps the students, remember the concepts that they're learning back in the classroom.
During this last school year, the 2014 and 15 school year, the Utah Natural History Museum's Taking Learning Outdoors program focused on the Little Bear Logan watershed in northern Utah. They worked with teachers in the Logan and Cache school districts.
We try to use water as a lens for everything that we bring to the teachers and students. So a really unique part of this program, too, is that the teachers have the opportunity to attend 2-day-long workshops where, for example, this past year we took them up to the Stokes Nature Center and took them in Logan Canyon, and we talked about water conservation and water quality and ecology in the canyon. And then that way we're giving the teachers, these hands-on experiences that they can then translate however they choose back in their classroom. So that's something that I'm really passionate about, is making sure that we're giving teachers really great, relevant, accurate information that they can then bring back to their students. And that's often through the lens of water. We get teachers outside right during that first workshop talking about, the wonders of the natural world. And then from there, we work with them one-on-one. Usually we'll have set up meetings with them one-on-one or Skype with them to figure out how they can implement outdoor activities with the students at school. In one teacher's classroom, his name was Mr. Cox, his fourth grade class, I had the opportunity to work outside with them at their playground, and we were discussing the different types of soil and which types of soil are best for harboring plant life, which ones are going to hold hold water the most, which ones are most nutrient-rich, and really how soil is created and why soil is so incredibly important to ecosystems for plants and animals and humans. It was really, really a great, really fun outdoor opportunity. You think about somewhere like down in someplace like Cedar City or, Hanksville, Utah or wherever, where you're just in this really kind of low elevation basin type desert where, you don't look out your window and see water, whereas the students that we're reaching over in West Valley, they see the Jordan River flowing right next to their playground at school. So definitely two different environments with water. Just to be able to see how excited the kids are when they're, feeling a bug or, picking a leaf off a tree or smelling a flower or something. To be able to see that firsthand is just, really wonderful.
Beginning this fall, Natalie Toth and other education outreach specialists at the Utah Museum of Natural History will take learning outdoors once again as a way of helping to educate our youth about water. For The Source, I'm Carrie Bringhurst.
Got a lot of things I'm supposed to do, but I don't want to see nobody except you.
The Source comes from the studios of Utah Public Radio with major support from iUtah, helping to shape Utah's water future through statewide research, science, and education. I'm Jennifer Pemberton, captain of this ship we call The Source. I produced this month's program with excellent contributions from First Mates Ross Chambliss, Ryan Cunningham, and Carrie Bringhurst. Megan Simper is the sweet, sweet siren who wrote and played our theme music. You can listen to previous episodes of The Source at upr.org while you wait for next month's show to come out. If you want to talk about it on social media, the hashtag for the show is UPRSource. Thanks for listening.
It's the Beehive Archive on Utah Public Radio. I'm Megan Van Frank. This week, learn about Verla Jean Miller, Farm and Farm Ion, beloved teacher to many Utah school children, and how one decision to travel set her on a fantastic journey that changed her life. First this.
I'm Cynthia Buckingham, Director of Utah Humanities. Beehive Archive is brought to you on Utah Public Radio by Utah Humanities with the generous support of the Lawrence T. and Janet T. D. Foundation. We are proud to partner with community organizations to tell Utah stories and hope you will tune in each week for the Beehive Archive.
Welcome to the Beehive Archive, a two-minute look at some of the most pivotal and peculiar events in Utah's history. In 1945, Verla Jean Miller made a decision to travel to the eastern United States, a decision that would radically change the course of her life. Born the daughter of a beekeeper in Smithfield, Utah, Verla Jean moved around with her family's honey business, sparking a lifelong interest in new people and different ways of life. She put herself through college at the University of Utah and taught fifth grade in Cedar City. Eager to see more of the world, she declined another year's teaching contract and chose instead to leave Utah. Verla Jean's travels landed her in New York City as a governess and student at Columbia University Teachers College. One night in 1952, she skipped class to attend a play. Next to her sat a man, Manasher Farman Farmayan, who was a prince from an old Persian royal family. The two soon married and moved to Iran. For Verla Jean, living in Iran would prove to be both a geographical and cultural journey. Iran was adjusting to social and political changes resulting from a recent military coup. Verla Jean's new family was large. Some were Muslim, others were not. Some of the women wore the traditional chador, others were more westernized. Verla Jean struggled with the expectations for women and with the Persian language, but enjoyed Persian food, art, and literature. She also worked, helping the Queen with her charities, teaching English at the Iran-American Society, even leading a Girl Scout camping trip to the Caspian Sea. In 1955, Verla Jean and Manasher had a daughter, but eventually decided their differences were too great and separated. Verla Jean raised their daughter in Holland before returning to Utah after 20 years of international adventure. She also returned to teaching fifth grade and inspired a generation of students until her retirement at 73. Verla Jean had come full circle. Her journey from Utah and back was filled with a richness of life few can rival, and all from one fateful decision to travel. This episode of the Beehive Archive was contributed by Heidi Tock. Sources and past episodes may be found at utahhumanities.org. For the Beehive Archive, a production of the Utah Humanities Council, I'm Megan Van Frank.